WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the Battle of the Speeches.
Two men, one the President of the United States and the other the former Vice President, right now are preparing to deliver dueling speeches on how to deal with terrorists.
The showdown over national security. President Obama and former Vice President Dick Cheney going toe-to-toe in back-to-back speeches.
The major newspapers framed it the same way, and for 24 hours there was absolute media consensus. Back-to-back policy speeches by the President and the former Vice President constituted a clash of titans. But did they really? Dick Cheney has been waging a month-long media campaign to defend Bush administration interrogation abuses and to portray Obama as soft on terrorism. His principal argument? Waterboarding saved American lives. Never mind the facts or legality or morality or even logic. Systematic war crimes could save American lives, too. The question is, have the media erred and even influenced the political dynamic by portraying an immensely unpopular ex-VP as equal and opposite to the President of the United States? Simply put, has the press invented a drama where none really exists? We put this question to Mark Jerkowitz of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, who explained that the media just love the reductionism of a head-to-head clash, but that, he says, doesn't mean the conflict is contrived or unimportant.
One of the things that the media claimed in the run-up to the Iraq War was that their failure to more closely scrutinize the rationale for going to war, weapons of mass destruction, part of that could be attributable to the fact that there weren't very many Democrats articulating an opposition that they could report about to Bush's war plans. Now, you could argue in those days that the Democrats didn't have much more power than the Republicans have right now. But clearly, the media would have glommed on to some major Democratic spokespeople had they arisen to challenge the policy. So it's hard to calculate how much influence could Cheney have on policy. Is he getting overcovered at this moment? That's quite possible. Is it likely that the President of the United States is going to be able to maintain control of this narrative in the long run? Absolutely. Do the media tend to get a little overexcited when they can simply find an opposition leader with some credibility who emerges? Probably at this point. But I don't think that's an issue that, frankly, is going to last all that far into the future.
Let me tell you something we discussed in our meeting. I'm curious to know what your reaction is to it. It was my suggestion that one of the reasons that the coverage has been the way it is that the press as an institution is simply just kind of wide-eyed about Cheney's tour of news shows. I mean, I certainly don't remember an ex-vice president, certainly one who left an office in such low esteem, going on the offensive like this, certainly not in my lifetime. Is it unprecedented?
There are two man-bites-dog elements to that story. One is, it does seem unusual, and that's been an element of coverage, to see somebody from a previous administration so aggressively go after his successor after such a short period of time. And obviously, that's in stark contrast, for example, to President Bush, who has opted for silence, and that's traditionally the way it's worked. Number two is, there was a mythology that grew around Cheney when he was vice president of the man who operated in the shadows, who largely gave interviews to the Fox News Channel when he wanted to go public.
The power behind the throne.
Exactly. And now suddenly, he's Oprah Winfrey. You know, he's all over television. And certainly that seems out of character. And that is part of what's fueling it.
One final question. The president scheduled his Thursday speech after Dick Cheney scheduled his before the American Enterprise Institute. Is the White House reacting to Dick Cheney? Or is it, you know, coincidence?
Well, you know, you'd have to talk to their strategist. It would seem to be hard to believe that's a coincidence. I think they've noticed how much attention Cheney's gotten. Part of it is also driven by the fact that the president, and even his allies will say this, needs to do some explaining of his own policy. This has not been a seamless couple of weeks for him when it comes to national security issues. He reversed himself on the release of the photos. He was handed, at least temporarily, a legislative defeat on the closing of Guantanamo Base by his own party in the Senate. So he is finding that the execution of this policy is no mean feat. One of the things that's fascinating, and to show you, you know, how easily it is to translate this story into a political battle and why it is that the media love the red corner and the blue corner, I saw on you know, the Politico.com website today, their instant poll was, which speech on national security are you going to watch? When you can boil a very dicey and nuanced and complex national security issue down to who you're going to watch on television, you've got a story that the media can run with.
All right, Mark. As always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Cherkowitz is an associate director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism.
Giant against giant in a duel to the death. You'll see it all in Godzilla versus Megalon.
This week, we saw another blow to transparency. On Tuesday, a federal appellate court issued a ruling saying that the White House Office of Administration does not have to turn over documents explaining how millions of Bush administration emails went missing and what archiving systems have been put in place to prevent this from happening again. The ruling, by three judges appointed by Republican presidents, argued that the Office of Administration is not a White House agency and therefore not bound by transparency rules for the White House. The losers in the case were the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, who originally filed the FOIA request in 2007 asking for the documents. Their chief counsel, Ann Weissman, joins me now. Ann, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Now, this Office of Administration is part of the White House, but the court has ruled that, for the purposes of FOIA anyway, it is not part of the executive branch, and I'm not sure how those two things can be true simultaneously.
It's a little hyper-technical. Let me try to explain it. Within the executive office of the president, there are multiple different components. Some of those are agencies, like the Office of Management and Budget, the Council on Environmental Quality. And what that means is that they have to comply with the Freedom of Information Act. Other components of the Executive Office of the President are recognized to not be agencies. They're all under this umbrella organization, the Executive Office of the President, but some are subject to transparency laws and some are not.
Now, that makes perfect sense, but the twist in all of this is that before this ruling, the Office of Administration had in the past frequently responded to FOIA requests and even had a policy for handling FOIA requests.
Well, yes, the Office of Administration was created by President Carter in the 1970s, and from its outset, it was considered to be an agency. It wasn't until the Bush administration and our FOIA request. They had it in hand, they'd agreed to process it, and then at the point where they were going to have to tell us what documents they had and whether or not they were going to produce them, they suddenly declared that they are not an agency. So this was a very radical shift. And again, the import of the shift was that all of these documents are not publicly available anymore.
Okay, so we know that the Bush administration was a kind of 8-year ongoing stonewall, but now comes the Obama administration. Surely the transparency president will undo this problem and reopen the Office of Administration to FOIA requests and give the public access to the explanation for the missing emails, right?
Well, I wish I could share your certainty, but I think the record so far is far too unclear to be certain one way or the other what he's going to do. My organization, along with 36 other organizations, sent a letter to the White House counsel saying, you've embraced and endorsed transparency. It has to begin at home. Make the records of the Office of Administration publicly available, just like every president except for President George Bush has done. And we haven't heard yet.
But you may have some inkling based on a separate lawsuit that your organization has filed concerning the Bush administration emails.
Well, yes. After we filed this FOIA request, we filed a separate lawsuit claiming that the White House was violating their legal obligations because they knew that millions of email were missing, they failed to take any action to restore those records, and they failed to have in place an effective record-keeping system that would prevent this from happening again. On President Obama's first full day in office, their White House filed a motion in that case asking that the lawsuit be dismissed. And the grounds they gave was that they had done a limited project to restore a very limited number of the missing email, and they shouldn't have to do anything more. Needless to say, this was a very disappointing action on their part. But I would point out there's another lawsuit, a lawsuit from the Bush era, that I think also sends a very troubling message. And that's our quest to get the visitor records that the Secret Service creates when people go to the White House. The Bush administration, for the first time, took the view that those were presidential records, which meant they were not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. We won that battle in the court. It's back in court. Last week, they filed a brief in the Court of Appeals that makes it clear that the Obama administration is continuing the argument that these records are not agency records and are not available to the public. When we put all this together, we see a very troubling and inconsistent pattern, and we're just not sure what it means.
Now, we've been having conversations like this on this show for going on 4 months now, as various guests have been flummoxed by the administration's position on the state secret privilege, and now these email cases. What's your best guess as to what's going on?
President Obama and his administration have a large number of very pressing issues to deal with. And I think that my organization and others would be willing to give them some time to sort this out, except for one thing. President Obama kind of picked the timing by declaring on January 21st through various memoranda that he came out with that he was committed to transparency and accountability and that these were very important goals in his administration.
Not to mention his campaigning on that very issue.
Exactly. I mean, I don't pretend to really know the answer. I remain hopeful that when they are forced to focus on these issues, that they will come out on the side of transparency. But I raised the Secret Service example because that's one where I'm especially troubled, because when they were ordered by the court to file a brief, then they were forced to evaluate the situation and decide, you know, are we going to continue to say that the public doesn't have a right to know who visits the White House, or are we going to embrace transparency? And so far, what they've elected to do is embrace the same policies of the Bush White House, the anti-transparency policies.
Anne, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Anne Weissman is Chief Counsel for Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, D.C. This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people. This is Katya, Senior Producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Civilian casualties from airstrikes have always been a PR problem for the U.S. military and intelligence agencies, but recent civilian death tolls in Pakistan and Afghanistan have outraged those populations and threatened to hamper the fight against the Taliban. There have also been critics at home. In an op-ed last weekend in the New York Times, David Kilcullen, former senior advisor to General David Petraeus on counterinsurgency, called for a moratorium on CIA drone strikes in Pakistan as a means of countering the bad press and with an eye to influencing U.S. air war doctrine. The U.S. Air Force is giving reporters unprecedented access to one of the most important and controversial weapons in its arsenal, the unmanned drone. In a 60 Minutes segment 2 weeks ago, reporter Lara Logan reported from Creech Air Force Base outside of Las Vegas, where the drones are controlled.
Every so often in the history of war, a new weapon comes along that fundamentally rewrites the rules of battle. This is a story about a revolution in unmanned aviation that's doing just that.
Noah Schachtman, contributing editor at Wired magazine, was also given access to the drones at Creech. He joins us now. Noah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to discussing drones and piloted aircraft, I want to talk about the general PR problem attendant to asymmetrical warfare, namely that the bad guys are lurking within the civilian population and the kind of calculations you have to make before you start firing missiles at them.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. You know, if these guys were just out in the open, kind of gathering in masses like German troops would have during World War II, there wouldn't really be a PR problem. We'd just send the drones after them and bomb the crap out of them. But because they are hiding among civilian populations and blending in civilian populations, and because some of the militants might themselves be civilians one day and militants the next, it's very hard to separate them out. And the result far too often is civilian casualties. And every time there are civilian casualties, it's another PR coup for the Taliban.
Yeah, even though we have seen this again and again, whether it's in the Israeli invasion of Gaza and Hamas's tactics, or you know, even the Serbs, when NATO was bombing Belgrade and the command and control was in the basement of hospitals, the anger always accrues to the attacker, not to those hiding within civilian populations. Why does it always work?
I think one of the reasons it works is because the U.S. has done such a good job at awing the world with its superior technology that they assume that our high-tech ultra-precise weapons from the air hit exactly where we want them to hit and hit exactly who we want them to hit. And so while people on the ground in the Balkans or in Southwest Asia assume that a bullet goes astray or that a rocket-propelled grenade might go astray, there's the sense that the American drones and the American manned aircraft are so precise that one of their bombs couldn't possibly go astray.
Now, in your piece in Wired, you observe how infatuated the press has become with the drones and how they kind of got sucked into this PR exercise by the Air Force. But who is the target for the stories that come out after, you know, open access to Creech Air Force Base?
Okay, so I think there are two charm offensives. Charm offensive number one is being waged very quietly and in whispers by the CIA. And they're the ones controlling the drones over Pakistan, and they want to tell reporters on the sly that, hey, these things are working. And so therefore, you should let us continue this and don't put pressure on us. Charm offensive number two is from the Air Force, and they are letting some reporters, myself included, to what are secret operations. But I think that that charm offensive is almost in response to reporters' questions. I was hanging out with a bunch of other defense reporters recently, and they were joking that the only things their editors were interested in were pirates, drones, and don't ask, don't tell, which led to a bunch of jokes about how if only there were drones versus gay pirates, some sort of conflict there, that their editors would be ultimately happy. So I think the Air Force is responding to journalists' requests. And I also think that within the Air Force and within the military, there's a fight over what the future of the military is going to look like. And I think the Air Force is in a vigorous campaign with other military services to get its slice of the military funding pie. And so it wants to show off what it sees as its biggest contribution to the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that's the drones.
There was one curious wrinkle in this discussion. That came when former Air Force Secretary Michael Wynn got in touch with your magazine to say that we are losing the PR war with respect to airstrikes, piloted and drone alike, and he believes that the solution is to let military bloggers have a freer hand. What's he talking about?
At the start of the Iraq war, there were dozens and dozens of frontline soldiers who recorded the war and recorded their experiences of the war in their own personal blogs. And so we got a really interesting view of what was happening on the ground from the soldiers themselves. It wasn't too long afterwards, though, that the military freaked out about this and worried that there was going to be all kinds of security violations because these soldiers had access to the press or to the world, God forbid. And so there were very stringent regulations put in place that drastically cut down on the number of frontline blogs. And so now we're in a position today where the soldiers who know the most about these controversial incidents are often the ones that are least able to talk about them. And so what former Air Force Secretary Michael Wynn suggested is, hey, let these guys blog again. Let them talk about, hey, if they were caught in a firefight and the only way they were going to survive was for a airplane to drop a 500-pound bomb on some Taliban, let them talk about that experience. And in so doing, regain a foothold in this public relations contest.
Noah, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Noah Shachtman is contributing editor at Wired Magazine. Last week saw the beginnings of a multi-million dollar ad campaign by opponents of Obama's not yet announced health care reform plan. The ads featured Britons and Canadians who say they've been let down by their country's healthcare programs.
If you have cancer in the UK today, you're going to die quicker than any other country in Europe.
Those spots, brought to you by the PR firm responsible for the swift boating of John Kerry, mark the beginning of round two in the U.S. healthcare wars. The political right won the first round when it knocked down Hillary Clinton's proposed healthcare reforms back in 1994. We wondered if this preemptive strike could, in fact, derail healthcare reform efforts a second time around, especially when we recognized a familiar voice making the cable news rounds.
Embedded in this stimulus legislation, which has already passed, provisions that will mean less health care for you.
That voice belongs to Elizabeth McCoy. Way back in 1994, she wrote a piece for the New Republic called No Exit, which radically reframed the health care debate. McCoy claimed to have painstakingly gone through the bill as a disinterested observer months before she happened to run, successfully, as a Republican lieutenant governor. At the time, The Atlantic's James Fallows wrote about the article and found that McCoy's reading of the bill didn't exactly square with the bill as written.
What she found was something that was summarized in her article by saying, quote, "The law will prevent you from going outside the system to buy basic health coverage you think is better. Quote, the doctor can be paid only by the plan, not by you. That is, you'd be stuck with this presumably mediocre government health insurance coverage and nothing else. It would be the nightmare of the East German medical system where you were stuck with no anesthesia and whatever the government doctor decided to give you."
So the New Republic is an influential magazine. However, it is an American idol. Not every American is even aware that it exists, much less following every policy wonkish piece about health care reform in it. It took talk radio and the rest of the Republican echo chamber to turn her piece into conventional wisdom.
George Will was a crucial link in the chain because in his Newsweek column, he turned the idea that you wouldn't be able to choose your doctor into the doctors in jail, that phrase, which then turned up in talk radio. The quote from his column was, quote, "It would be illegal for doctors to accept money directly from patients, and there would be 15-year jail terms for people driven to bribery for care they feel they need, but the government does not deem necessary," unquote. Now, this was just simply wrong, and there was no provision in the bill for anything like this, but Rush Limbaugh had the doctors in jail theme, which then was propagandized, and doctors in jail beat whatever Hillary Clinton and the rest were able to say against it. One intermediate factor is that the White House prepared a rebuttal to McCoy's piece, which the New Republic failed to run, and there wasn't a blogosphere then to say, look, doctors in jail is just wrong.
You know, I was going to ask you a question. Where were the Andrew Sullivans of 1994, you know, the bloggers who come in and truth squad assertions of this sort and dissect them and so forth, but I know where Andrew Sullivan was in 1994.
Yes, you raised the awkward truth that Andrew Sullivan was the editor of the New Republic at that time, who both ran the piece and then didn't run the reply from the White House. Andrew Sullivan is now my colleague and friend of the Atlantic Monthly, with whom I agree on most items of policy. This is one where we disagree about whether that piece should have been run in the first place and whether the White House's reply should have been carried. And I think it's a really important fact about the ecology of news and opinion in the time since then. We can lament many things about the rise of sort of politically anchored cable news channels, so there is MSNBC against Fox, and there are all these blogospheres. But it meant that in those days, something that was plainly false and provably false could not be knocked down because there wasn't an alternative machine to deal with it.
And then there is the historical efficacy of the big lie to begin with. If you can somehow distill the public's fears around a horrifying notion, it sort of doesn't matter whether it's true or not. You can still worry the public, no?
It's a great point. And here's the illustration of it. The big lie is, if you pay your doctor for care you need, he's going to jail for 15 years and maybe you too. Here's the rebuttal to it, which is essentially almost on the first page of the act, which says, quote, nothing in this act shall be construed as prohibiting any individual from purchasing any health care services, unquote. Now, that's pretty clear legally in a court of law that would carry the day, but it doesn't have the same punch as doctors in jail.
So I guess what it comes down to is this, Jim. 15 years ago, there was no blogosphere. There was no talking points memo to go over the healthcare proposal line by line. Can you swift boat a policy issue in 2009 in the way that they were able to pull off during the Clinton administration?
You can probably do it in some way, but I think that particular form of misinformation is a lot harder now. And interestingly, there's a test case to this effect, because back in February of this year, the same Elizabeth McCoy had a similar kind of foray she was using preemptively against Obama's health care plans. There was part of the stimulus bill which had a provision trying to expand the use of electronic medical records, and she misinterpreted this as being something that would restrict the kind of care doctors could give, which was not the case at all. The significant thing is there was instant feedback. There were bloggers from all over the place, including in a modest way me, saying, look, this just is false. And that didn't get any kind of traction. And so in that one test case, you know, if the same kind of response system had been there 15 years ago, the results could have been different.
Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
James Fallows writes for The Atlantic and is the author of Postcards from Tomorrow's Square, Reports from China. At the beginning of this month, 60 Minutes aired a report titled Amazon Crude, about the oil giant Chevron.
Soon, a judge in a tiny Ecuadorian courtroom will decide whether the oil company must pay as much as $27 billion in damages.
That would 3 weeks before this segment aired, a video popped up on YouTube weighing in on the same issue with the same TV news look and feel.
A bitter environmental lawsuit against Chevron appears to be entering its critical phase in Ecuador. The plaintiffs say when Chevron bought Texaco Incorporated in 2001, it assumed that company's environmental liability in Ecuador. Chevron says it is the victim of a massive misinformation campaign in which facts are twisted and scientific data are ignored.
The face looked familiar, too. The guy doing the stand-up is Gene Randall, who spent 20 years as a correspondent for NBC and CNN. Now a corporate media consultant, Randall was hired by Chevron to counter whatever negative publicity might flow from the 60 Minutes piece. With $27 billion at stake, it's not shocking that Chevron wanted to use all the tools available for the PR battle. But when does PR become a fake news masquerade? Randall joins me now. Gene, welcome to the show.
Bob, thanks very much for the invitation.
So what responsibility do you have as the producer of this piece to make sure that it doesn't look so much like a news report that the audience takes it for a news report?
I don't think it's my responsibility to produce something that doesn't look like a news report. It's my responsibility to put together a report which is as compelling as possible. I mean, why should a business have to count on a press release to get its story out, whatever that business is? It was prominently featured on the Chevron website. I really don't see how there could be any question that this was a Chevron-sponsored event.
And so therein my quibble. I certainly don't have any qualms about Chevron or any other corporation putting its best foot forward.
Right.
Where it crosses the line to me is when the presenter is trading on his journalistic credentials to create a report that by definition is tilted to the paying client.
This is a valid question. Are you cashing in on your credibility? But you know, when you leave journalism, as I did, and it becomes apparent that you're no longer young enough or glitzy enough to stay in the field where you spent 30 years of your life, you're faced with a very heavy decision. How do you enter the job market? You do it with the skills you have so that you can make a living and support your family. My skills included writing and communicating. Those are the skills I offer my clients. And this is not only true for the Chevrons of this world, but, you know, for groups like the Cooperative Development Foundation, which hired me to produce a video on how co-ops could help alleviate the problems with senior citizens.
Got to say, as you view the video on either on the Chevron site or on YouTube, where it was also posted, mm-hmm. You're standing there in a control room, much like a network TV news operation control room. You say this is Gene Randall reporting. It certainly leaves a whole lot of room for confusion.
You know, maybe I shouldn't have used the word reporting. Maybe I should have said Gene Randall. But I don't think that's the core objection that people are raising. I think the real objection critics of the video have raised is that I'm presenting this as someone who long was a part of the journalism world. Well, I'm no longer a part of that world. I mean, I think that's the real objection, not the fact that I said reporting, but the fact that I was a correspondent. I was a television anchor for all those years. But the key word is former. I'm a former journalist.
When you talk about what someone in your position is to do with his skills and his talents, sounded to me like you yourself are kind of biting your tongue, holding your nose, rationalizing it because you got to make a living. Are you doing any of those things?
No, I wouldn't say so. I'm happy doing the work that I do now. You know, I'm proud of the work that I do now. Look, I'll tell you, all those years ago when I left CNN, I wouldn't say that was a matter of choice. I was clearly part of the cutbacks because they paid me too much. It wasn't worth it for them to keep me after all those years. And I tried to stay in journalism, you know, for a long time until I realized that my credentials didn't really count for much in that job market anymore. So, no, I'm not apologizing for what I do now at all. Given the choice way back then, I would have stayed in broadcasting. I really didn't have much of a choice.
To me, the irony of all of this is that your background and your credentials and your experience seem more valuable to your corporate clients than they were to CNN.
There is a certain irony there, isn't there?
Gene, you knew you were in for an inquisition, so I especially appreciate your coming on.
Listen, I appreciate the invitation, and thanks very much to you.
Gene Randall is a corporate consultant and former reporter who left CNN in 2001. Coming up, the timeless art of the pitch. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Last year, total U.S. ad spending across all media fell more than 2.5% as recession-racked companies slashed their budgets to simply stay afloat. That's been good news, however, for the infomercial industry, which is taking advantage of cheaper airtime to hawk its wares. Advertising for so-called direct response products went up nearly 10% in 2008 for everything from the Snuggie to the ShamWow.
It's like a chamois, it's like a towel, it's like a sponge. This is for the house, the car, the boat, the RV.
For the first time in its history, Avon, which calls itself the company for women, is now recruiting its sales force with a direct response ad of its own. It seems the lowly infomercial, much maligned by those with Madison Avenue standards, is finally having its moment in the sun. So far this year, the infomercial industry has garnered a book, a reality show, and even a television documentary by CNBC. We asked our producer Mike Volo to find out what is so compelling about the hard sell.
Growing up in northern New Jersey in the 1970s and 80s, I would make regular trips down to Atlantic City with my family when school was out. There are certain sounds that stick out in my memory from those summers on the boardwalk. The ocean, of course. Seagulls screeching overhead just outside the Planters peanut store. The arcade. Oh yeah, and this guy.
There's no pumps, there's no motors, there's no batteries. It works direct from a bucket. Wash your car, your boat, your camper, your trailer.
That's Billy Mays pitching the amazing Washmatic, a portable cleaning system. If you weren't a professional pitchman, you might call it a 10-foot hose, a simple siphon with a one-way valve. It helps you save water.
One bucket to wash, one bucket to rinse.
Mays would set up on the boardwalk with a Washmatic and a minivan door and pitch that product all day. It earned him the nickname Bucket Billy. Mays says he learned from some of the best pitchmen we'll never know, guys selling everything from fishing gear to facial cream, and he counts himself among the last of the old mold. He even uses the jargon of the hard sell during conversation. You don't gather a crowd, you bally one. And it's not a crowd, it's a tip. Like a lot of pitchmen, Mays gets something close to reverential when he talks about what those in the industry call the turn.
All this so important turn. When you have that perfect pitch going, you better ask for the money. You better turn them right there because they're ready. They're ready to pull out the $20 right then and there. They already got it waving in the air. Sometimes that turn didn't always happen so quick. You had to go clap and bring them out of it. You're number one. You're number two. One thing you didn't want to happen, the front of your tip, break up and leave. You know, if you leave now, I'll never talk to you. Don't you dare do that right now. You kind of just force them to stay.
Mays pitched the Washmatic on the boardwalk, on the pier, and at state fairs for more than 10 years. It was in 1993 at the Pittsburgh Home and Garden Show that he met Max Apple, an amateur inventor who developed a citrus cleaner in his garage in Colorado. A few years later, Apple hired Mays to pitch the product, Orange Glow Wood Cleaner and Polish, on TV.
Made with pure orange oil. It cleans, polishes, and protects all of
Mays sold 6,000 bottles the first day, and then Apple expanded his business, with Mays again as the pitch man, to include something he called OxyClean.
It's powered by the air you breathe, activated by the water that you and I drink. In your laundry, the power of bleach, but it's safe. Watch this.
And ever since, late at night, early in the morning, whenever TV channels have cheap airtime to sell, Billy Mays has been coming into our homes.
Hi, Billy Mays here for Mighty Putty. Hi, Billy Mays here for the Big City Slider Station.
Hi, Billy Mays here for the Steam Buddy.
Hi, Billy Mays here for the Jupiter Jack.
Hi, Billy Mays back again with the Awesome Auger.
Hi, Billy Mays here for the Toll Bandit.
Hi, Billy Mays here for the world's greatest insole, Impact Gel. Why am I smashing my hand with this hammer? To show you the amazing protection you get from Impact Gel.
That last product, Impact Gel, in case you couldn't hear him, is featured in the first episode of Mays' new reality show on the Discovery Channel called Pitchmen. Billy Mays.
You know, if you ask me what I am right now, I am a pitchman. I only know how to do one thing, sell products. It was taboo at certain times during my career where we would call ourselves professional demonstrators. Now, I'm proud to say I, Billy Mays, am a pitchman. That's what I am.
I think it's a term that historically rises and falls.
Glenn Hinson is a folklorist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He says that during the old medicine shows of the late 19th century, a pitchman would prefer to call himself a talker and to call his pitch a lecture.
The idea of the lecture was to somehow wrap the rhetoric of the remarkable in the framing of the familiar. You wanted to invite your audience, the tip, to think differently about what they needed in their lives so that the audience would reach into their pockets, pull out that dollar bill for that bottle of tonic, and make the purchase.
I'm going to paint a word picture that the smallest boy or girl in the audience can understand. Those of you that keep house, you have sitting at your back door what we call a slop bucket or a garbage can.
One medicine show doctor, Dr. Fred Bloodgood, he used to say that the credo of many of the med show talkers was never use one word when four would suffice.
I've been putting that same food into my stomach, not for a day, not for a week, a month, or a year, but for 5 years, for 10 years, and I've never cleaned it out.
The first nail in the coffin of the old med shows was the Federal Food and Drugs Act of 1906. Its stated purpose was to prevent, quote, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of adulterated or misbranded or poisonous or deleterious foods, drugs, medicines, and liquors.
Something that would pass a tapeworm, head and all.
That put the medicine show on notice, and it eventually died out. Glenn Hinson.
In the history of medicine shows, if you look at those performers who went on from there, performers would move into vaudeville. They would move more particularly into places like the Grand Ole Opry. And in the Grand Ole Opry, where you have this idea of a radio show that combined pitches with entertainment, with the advent of television, is a very simple move to make.
In the late 1940s, a guy named Nat Morris was hiring people, mostly his own family, to pitch products on the boardwalks of New Jersey. Nat Morris was the head of an extended family dynasty of pitchmen. In-laws, cousins, nephews. His own son, Arnold, was something of a pitching prodigy. You know that gimmick where some guy cuts through metal to demonstrate just how sharp the knife is? Arnold invented that 60 years ago.
This could be a chicken bone. It could be a ham bone, frozen food. This is steel against steel. Take a look at this. Something has to give. You see those filings over here? Now, there's only one way to find out if that knife is still razor sharp. You go back to the same tomato today, tonight, tomorrow, next week, next year, for the rest of your life, you never, ever have to sharpen a knife.
Between the years 1948 and 1954, the number of American households owning TV sets shot from less than 1% to more than 55%. It was during that time that the Morrises took the pitches they perfected on the boardwalks and filmed them as commercials. Modern-day medicine show talkers beamed right into our homes. They even shot half-hour spots, what we would now call infomercials, for the old Dumont network. They were disguised as cooking shows, but the whole point was to sell a Morris family product called the Roto-Broil, a rotisserie.
Hi, this is Lester Morris, the Roto Magician, and here's our menu for today. Smorgasbord, Swedish meatballs, sill salad, and scandifus casserole.
Remember I said extended family dynasty? The Morrises were related to the Popeels, who struck gold in the 1960s with a whole line of kitchen gadgets, the Veg-O-Matic, Dial-O-Matic, even a Whip-O-Matic, pushing the infomercial pitch so deep into our pop cultural psyche that Dan Aykroyd spoofed it on Saturday Night Live in 1976.
How many times has this happened to you? You have a bass. You're trying to find an exciting new way to prepare it for dinner. You could scale the bass, remove the bass's tail, head, and bones, and serve the fish as you would any other fish dinner. But why bother now that you can use Robco's amazing new kitchen tool, the Super Bass-O-Matic 76?
Yes, if anyone could sell Aykroyd's Bass-O-Matic,
the tool that lets you use the whole bass.
Surely it would be Ron Popeil. Of the entire clan of Morrises and Popeils, some of the best salesmen America has ever seen, it is Ron who has been the most successful. It is Ron who has elevated the infomercial to its grand synthesis of theater and commerce. It is Ron who best put to practice the old pitchman's axiom. It's not what you sell. It's how you tell them the price.
You know you're not going to spend $400 for it, not $375 or $350, not $325 or even $300, not $275 or $250, not $225 or even $200 like you all may be thinking, not $190 or even $180. All you spend for this fabulous machine, an over $400 value, all you spend is just four easy monthly payments of $39.95.
They never tell you what the full price is because psychologists have done research on this and found that breaking things into smaller payments fools the human mind into thinking that it's really not the same thing.
Remy Stern is the author of But Wait, There's More, a book about the infomercial industry. He says another pitchman's ploy is to push the idea that time is running out, which he could do pretty convincingly on the boardwalk.
Usually he has more, probably in his truck about a block away. But the boxes that you'll see standing right next to him, there'll be a limited number, and he'll use that to his advantage to suggest that if you don't act now, you're not going to get this fantastic offer, which has since migrated to television, that same sense of creating this false scarcity.
False scarcity, though, is not as believable on TV. To reinforce the idea, then, an infomercial might use a counter to tick down the time. Sometimes there's a counter running up, tallying the number of items sold. This communicates what psychologists call social proof. If lots of other people are doing it, then you should too. And if you're not, what's wrong with you? Testimonials from people who are in a studio audience or may seem to be plucked randomly off the street serve a similar purpose.
I don't have to go to the store to buy a rotisserie chicken. I can make my own now and it comes out just scrumptious. I love it.
Social proof is often built right into the structure of an infomercial, where the pitchman works with a host who is ever so incredulous at first. Remy Stern.
She'll usually start off the infomercial with questions like, I can't really believe it does this, Jack.
You can make pasta with the Popeil automatic pasta maker in under 3 minutes.
From scratch?
No.
From scratch?
From scratch.
She's proxy for the people at home who are saying the same thing, which is, I can't believe it does that. Over the course of the infomercial, you'll watch that her tone changes and she'll finally sort of succumb to the pitch and realize that this is the greatest machine she has ever seen.
It really is an exciting pasta maker, isn't it? I mean, the Popeil automatic pasta maker is sensational. Now, there's the 1-800 number on your screen. I don't know what you're waiting for. It can't get any better than this.
Near the end of an infomercial, a pitchman will make one last effort to hook you by upping what's called the perceived value of the deal.
In addition to that, you get a package of semolina flour. You also get a pasta fork. You get a measuring cup. You get $100 worth of coupons, as well as a recipe booklet with English and Spanish instructions.
When and how to ask for the money, false scarcity, social proof, perceived value.
Everybody that calls in the next 30 minutes will also receive absolutely free my new sausage-making attachment with spices and casings included.
Ron Popeil has turned the art of the infomercial into a science. And if Ron Popeil has brought the half hour form to its apotheosis, a company called Telebrands has done the same for the short form, spots that are no longer than a minute or two in length. Telebrands is headquartered in Fairfield, New Jersey. Displayed in the lobby of the building are honest-to-goodness trophies for products like the Better Pasta Pot and the World's Safest Can Opener. There's even a letter from a professor of mechanical design at Princeton University thanking Telebrands founder A.J. Kubani for a lecture he gave titled Finding Winning Products. That's what they do at Telebrands.
A lot of people see these commercials on TV and they say something like, well, you know, if that blanket with sleeves can sell, then anything will sell on TV.
Telebrands president and CEO A.J. Kubani.
Well, it's really not that simple. It's actually quite challenging to come up with a winning TV product. Even for us, we've been in the business for 26 years, and we still fail 90% of the time.
One of the first products Kubani advertised on TV was a pair of sunglasses in 1987.
Introducing AmberVision, the most amazing breakthrough in vision technology since glasses were invented.
He figured out that he could build brand recognition by blanketing the airwaves with cheap, direct-to-consumer commercials, and then take the product into retail stores where he slapped an As Seen on TV logo on them, which he designed himself. It's a very lucrative formula, he told me, so that's what he's been doing ever since. But Kubani says he has a few key requirements for any idea before Telebrands will even consider developing it into a product.
They all solve a common problem.
Are there places in your home where you wish you had a light, but you don't?
The other thing is that they have to be innovative, or at least perceived as being innovative.
Oh no, that tired old style's been around for a while. But now there's Easy Combs, the easy new way to create dozens of dazzling new hairstyles instantly.
They have to be easy to manufacture in mass, which means that they're usually low tech.
Fed up with spending hundreds of dollars on purses that just get soiled by dirty floors? Then you need Purse Hook.
Ramping up high-tech products can take a long time, and we don't have that kind of time.
That's because the life cycle for a product, from the time it hits the air to the time it leaves the stores, can be as short as a few months. But every now and then, Telebrands comes up with a big seller that may linger for a few years. These are the products that pay the salaries of the 40 or so employees and have made Kubani a wealthy man. Maybe you've heard of the Ped Egg. That's P-E-D. EGG, Kubani.
It's a product that removes calluses or dead skin from the bottoms of people's feet. It works the same way that a cheese grater does, except it's better blades, and it catches the shaved calluses so it doesn't make a mess.
Last year, more than 20 million people bought the Ped Egg. When I think back to the boardwalk of Atlantic City, as much as I can remember even the voices of some of the pitchmen out there, I can't remember if we ever bought anything. Turns out we did.
I bought knives, I bought choppers, I bought a blender.
My mother, Bella Vuolo.
They had the gadgets that made fancy vegetables, which I bought and could never do when I brought it home. They made it look so easy. You know, they sliced the tomato with one sweep. No, never happened.
My mother even has a few gadgets still tucked away in her closet. They're just waiting to transform her kitchen and change her life.
This is the Vidalia Chop Wizard that I was telling you about. It does not do an onion as good as they say. It's faster and easier by hand. I have a quick chopper, which I don't think I ever used. It's good for chopping, but you're a pretty good chopper. Oh, another one. This is a mixer jug. As you can see, I never used this one either. Some of the things I never used, brought it home and said, why did I buy it? And some things I did use.
Why did you buy it?
He was a good pitch man.
Ron Popeil likes to tell a story about his cousin, who sold a number of gadgets on the Atlantic City boardwalk in the 1950s. This cousin of his was such a good pitch man that one customer stood there and bought every item he had, only to walk away with two big shopping bags and toss the whole lot of it into a trash can not far away. Maybe that story's true, maybe it isn't. But it was in the 1950s that television took notice of the lowly pitch man for his ability to sell and lifted him up off the boardwalks and the street corners. Television, you could say, saved the pitch man. If TV ad rates keep slipping and traditional advertising becomes a thing of the past, maybe it'll be the pitch man's turn to save TV. For On the Media, I'm Mike Vuolo.
I need a Vegematic. I need a pocket fisherman.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Cara Gianfrido and Ethan Scheel. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Stanley Jacobs Productions provided some of the archival tape for our piece about pitchmen. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.